Erev Tov, Boker Tov, welcome to the third podcast in our series on the Haggadah Shel Pesach. As promised, we are going to complete what we did not complete in the last podcast, the section that is commonly known as the Arba'a Banim. And there are really three things left. First of all, the Tam and the She'ino Yodea Lishol, as presented in the Haggadah, and the question and the answer, or should we say the initiative of the parents in the latter case, and how that plays out, and also the concluding paragraph as it appears in the Haggadah and its relevance, and then we're going to use that to segue into a discussion of paragraphs that appear sequentially earlier in the Haggadah, and we will spend the rest of the shiur discussing essentially the two different modes that we've already talked about in the last podcast, the two different modes of discussion, that of Sipur and that of Haggadah. We analyzed at some length the child who is commonly called the Rasha, and the text in the Torah. There's one thing that we didn't get to, one thing I forgot to mention in the last podcast, is we notice that the answer given to this child, and again, if we only had the interaction in Exodus 12, in Shmot Yud Bet, the child who says, Ma avodah zot lachem, and the response, Zevach Pesach Hu, we would not know that there's anything untoward about his question. We would not know that there's anything disgracing or hurtful about the father's answer, until we compare them with the other text, which is indeed what Chazal say when they say there are... As if there were four children. In other words, the texts help to highlight within each other their differences so that we can understand what unique situation the text is addressing and what unique application the text is providing. In the case of that child who was called the Rasha, I noted in the last podcast that you do not speak to him. It doesn't say Vamartem Elav, it says Vamartem. But there's another component to the answer which is also significant. You know, when you tell the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, there are many, many angles that can be presented. There's political angles, there's military angles, there's issues of economic infrastructure and the climate of Egypt. And there's all sorts of historic angles that can be discussed. There's obviously tremendous theological angles and issues of liberation and liberation theology, etc. There's so much to discuss and a wide range of approaches to take to the issue of Yetziat Mitzrayim. All that would fit within the very, very large tent of the way that the Tanakh and the Masorah present the Exodus. However, when we look at the events themselves, we note that there are aspects of the Exodus, which of course are very glorious and very exciting and inspiring and uplifting. And of course, there are some events of the Exodus that are very depressing and very upsetting. And it's one thing if we say we walked out with a strong hand, Bnei Yisrael Yatzu B'Yad Ramah, that is a power statement. On the other hand, we have a statement like, we crossed the Red Sea, but the Egyptians were drowned. It's a power statement, but it's a power statement that carries a very sharp edge to it. In other words, some were saved and others were destroyed. When we look at the Exodus out of the context of the effect on the Egyptians, then we see something that is purely glorious. When we look at it within the context of the Egyptians, in other words, contrasting the celebration of Bnei Israel with the terror of the Egyptians, which of course reaches its highlight in two different points in the story. One, in Shmot Yud Bet in the middle, where Bnei Israel are sitting and rejoicing and eating their Korban Pesach, and at the same exact moment, their neighbors' homes are filled with screams because of the children dying. And then the second moment is when Bnei Israel gloriously and happily sing, if they've crossed, in Exodus 15, if they've crossed the Red Sea, and they're looking and watching the Egyptians drown there. However, there's yet a third way to present it, which, if you think about it, is quite a bit of a downer. And that is just to focus on the component of the destruction of the Egyptians, and look at Bnei Israel not as those who were redeemed and who were saved and who were brought to Yam Suf and then to Har Sinai and then to Eretz Yisrael, etc. but rather Bnei Yisrael who sort of made it out by the skin of their teeth. In other words, there was terrible destruction in Egypt, and we were saved. Saved in a sense, not saved from Egypt, but saved from that destruction. Well, you take a look at the answers that are given to the other children. For instance, the child who asked the question in Sefer Devarim, who we later identify as a Chacham, we'll talk about him in a moment. The answer given to him is, Avadim hayinu lefarug Mitzrayim, we were slaves, and God took us out with a strong hand, and with an outstretched arm, etc. And he put wonders and miracles against the Egyptians, and he gave us the Torah, and he gave us these mitzvot, and it's good for us for our entire life, etc., etc. So, of course, there is a contextual framework of what God did to the Egyptians, but there's also the great glory given to us. That is, if you will, a more sophisticated version of the interaction between the father and the son that takes place at the end of Parshat Bo, in chapter 13 of Exodus, verses essentially 11 through 16, where the child, as I noted in the last podcast, who notices the father separating the firstborn of the flock and giving it to the Kohen, asks Mazot, and the answer is that God took us out with a strong arm, and Pharaoh was stubborn, and God killed the firstborn, but it doesn't end there. And it should be for a sign on your eyes, a sign on your hand, and for a remembrance between you, for a remembrance between your eyes, because God took us out with a strong hand, etc. In other words, the Exodus is presented to this child as a combination of God's attack against the Egyptians, but also the subsequent and consequent glory given to Am Yisrael, totafot, or a crown, that we wear a crown on our head to remind us of the great glory that we experienced at that time. Good, and we wear a tefillin on our arm to remind us of the strong hand. Take a look at what the Shulchan Aruch says about what you have to think about when you put on tefillin, to remember the strong hand with which God took us out. So there is the double-edged sword there. When we have the answer to no question in Exodus 13, verse 8, we got a talavin chabayim ahu, the child that we identify as the child who cannot ask a question. So the answer given is really all positive. Ba'avur ze asad when I leave it, seitim mitzrayim, it is because of this, and the way Chazal understand it, this is referring to the matzah and the maror. You're pointing to the matzah and maror and saying, it's because of this that God took me out of Mitzrayim. In other words, to celebrate. And there's nothing really negative and nothing upsetting or depressing about the answer. Depressing is not really the right word. But there's nothing that has the shadow side of the events and the punishment side of the events mentioned there. Now let's look at the answer given to the first child. The one who says, Ma avodah zot lachem. What do we answer? Zevach Pesach hu l'Adonai. It is a Pesach offering. What does Pesach mean? So this is a dispute among the commentators whether Pesach means to pass over or to protect. Take a look at the comments of the different Rishonim in Shmot Yud Bet. At the beginning it says, "Ufasach Adonai lapetach." God will pasach over the door. Does it mean to pass over or to protect? In any case, the answer given to this child is, he protected or skipped over the houses. When he was killing the Egyptians, and he saved our houses. In other words, the answer here gives no clue to the fact that we left Egypt, that we left gloriously, that we walked in the desert and we came to Har Sinai. Anything positive, the entire thing is basically we escaped with the skin of our teeth. We listen to this answer against the background of the other answers. We realize that the message we're supposed to give to this child is a message which is a frightening message, a warning message. In Egypt, there were people who died and there were people who were saved, and what made the difference between being saved and being killed was taking their own initiative and participating with the rest of the community in the Korban Pesach, that which you, son, don't want to participate in. And therefore the conclusion is, if you were there, you would not have been redeemed. The child that we skipped is the one who in the Haggadah is the first child, but in the Torah is the last child. And that is the one who asks, I'm not going to identify him by name now, the one who asks, Ma ha'edot v'chukim v'mishpatim asher tzivah Adonai Eloheinu etchem. Of course, a very famous question is, why do we jump down the throat of the Rasha, the child we identify as the Rasha, for saying, Lachem, Lachem v'lo lo, ilu ha'yasham lo haya nigal. And here, the Chacham says, etchem. Right. So, interestingly enough, the version in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Perek Yod, Halacha Dalet, in the Yerushalmi Pesachim, actually indicates a change in the text. And there is the Chaya, the Chacham says, "My dor v'chokim hashpar shetva Adonai lehenu otanu." But that, of course, not the text of the Torah. So why is it that, at least in our version, we say etchem and nobody says boo, nobody's bothered by it? Well, one answer is contextual, which is that when it comes to worship, we all worship together. When you say lachem, you say, what is this worship to you? Meaning, I'm not participating. In the case in Dvarim, the child is asking a factual answer. This is a child who was not at Mount Sinai. And he's asking his parents who were there, what are the commandments that God, our God, commanded you? You were there, now tell me. So there's nothing untoward about the word etchem, but there's something far greater than that. As I pointed out in the last year, the word lachem on the part of the child who we identify as a rasha which is used by that child that we identify as a rasha, is not really a problematic word. It's only once we see the verb yomru, and we note that he's not really asking a question, and we compare that to the other interactions, we suddenly realize who this kid is, and therefore we make mincemeat out of every word that he says. Avodah, the Yerushalmi says, Tircha, Lachem, V'lo-lo. In other words, the Lachem is not really the problem. But once we know who this kid is, then every word that he says, suddenly we see in a different light. Now, we look at the Sefer Dvarim in Deuteronomy 6, and we see that a child turns to his father any time of the year and says, Ma ha'edot v'chukim v'mishpatim asher tziva Adonai Eloheinu otchem. What are the laws, etc., that God commanded you? So what makes this kid a chacham? So the simple answer is, sorry for mixing the children, but the simple answer to why this kid is a chacham is because he is asking to be taught the laws. He is not surprised by something he sees. He sees a Korban Pesach and says, whoa, what is this worship? He sees the setting aside of the firstborn of the flock and he says, what's this? Rather, he sits down and he initiates a question without being provoked. And that already puts him in a different category. And within the scheme of the Seder, as I mentioned a little bit in the first podcast, that puts him as somebody who's going to participate in a much more sophisticated and advanced level of the discussion, if you will, later on in the evening, whereas the other children need to be provoked by things that they see that are surprising, that cause them to say, what is this, what's going on, so that we can respond to their questions. And that's something we'll deal with in the next podcast. We talk about the quote-unquote four questions. I say quote-unquote because there are no four questions, but we'll see that then. But there's another piece to the puzzle that tells us that this child is a chacham. It's something Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out, that the child here does not ask an uncluttered, unsophisticated question, a question that has no texture to it, as mazot. He asks a question, unlike the child doesn't ask. And of course, he's not defiant, but there's something more to it. What he asks is not a simple question of what are the laws. He immediately categorizes laws into edot, Chukim and Mishpatim. Traditionally understood, although there's many ways to interpret the difference between them, a dot may refer to laws which testify to God, meaning we keep Shabbat to testify to creation, we wear tefillin to testify to the Exodus, etc. Chukim may mean laws which are not within the general rubric of human reason, and are not the sort of things that we would have come up on our own if trying to form a better society. And Mishpatim are civil and criminal laws. That's one way to skin it. There's a lot of other ways to read it. But the fact that he's categorizing, and this was very big in Rabbi Soloveitchik's mode of thinking that he received from his grandfather, the great Reb Chaim Brisker, is that the ability to categorize and to identify different components of halacha, of Jewish laws, belonging to different meta-categories, of meta-legal categories, is a sign of an advanced thinker. And it certainly is true within Piaget's stage development theory of how our ability to think, that it's only at a more advanced age, around 13 or 14, that we're able to think in abstract terms, which of course categorization is abstract, as opposed to the child who has to see an event and say, what is this? Or what are you doing? What does this mean to you? And so that's another reason why he might be called the Chacham. Now, we have to take a look at what happens in the Haggadah. The child in Dvarim asks the question, what are the laws? the Torah says to answer him with something that's not an answer. He asked, what are the laws? He didn't ask, what do they mean? He doesn't ask, why do we do them? He asked, what are they? Which means the answer should be, well, Sefer Dvarim, Sefer Vayikra, Shulchan Aruch, Sefer Achinuch, you know, Mishnah Berurah, it should be a halachic session. And instead, what does the Torah say to tell him? We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and God took us out with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. And God gave us these great laws. But at no point do we tell him what the laws are. Just said, God gave us these great laws. It's a very strange answer. What becomes doubly strange, or perhaps now a resolution, is the fact that in the Haggadah, we tell him, laws. And we tell him the laws of Ein Maftir Achar Pesach Afi Koman. There's much ink has been spilled on why that's the particular answer we give him. We will, for purposes of the Shir, take the mainstream approach, the most common approach, which is that we tell him all the laws of the Pesach, including and up to the very last law of the Korban Pesach, which is what to do after the Korban Pesach, and that is not to carouse and not to eat dessert, etc. But that's the last thing that you do in the meal. And that the phrasing should be Ve'af atay morlo kilchot ha-pesach ad Ein maftir nachar pesach ha-fikoman. However, there's much more to it than that, and in the penultimate shiur of this series, we will look at it from a very different perspective. But nonetheless, we'll take that approach. So in other words, the Haggadah says, answer the kid's question, which is to teach him halacha, sit down with him and learn halachot, as opposed to the way that the Torah presents it. So what's going on? So one explanation to this is one of framework. The framework and the context in which the child asks the question in the Torah is any time of the year. The child asks the question, whenever it might be, tell me the laws. And so at that point, the first thing you have to do is establish a basis for him. The basis is our history, the Exodus, Matan Torah, etc. And then, of course, the assumption is once you've done that and you've engaged the child that way, we'll talk about in a minute why that's so significant, then you start teaching him the halachot, as opposed to the context here, which is that the child is, as it were, at the Seder. And he turns around and asks, tell me the laws. Obviously he's at the Seder, because otherwise, why would the thing that you answer him be the laws of Pesach? There's no reason, if he's asking a question in December, tell me all the halachot that God gave us, that you're going to sit and learn the laws of Korban Pesach in detail. So it's clear that within the framework of the Haggadah, this child is asking the question on Pesach. And therefore the answer you give him assumes the story, because that's the framework within which he's asking the question, and then you go further and you tell him and give him an answer. There's yet another piece to the puzzle, though. And this goes back to why the Torah answers the way that it does. I'll tell you from personal experience. I have, Baruch Hashem, been given many opportunities to give public shiur, public community lectures, in which everybody is invited. And often, in the context that I do it, it is done in sort of a tag team fashion. Often we have, before the high holidays, before Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, we have a set of lectures on a particular Sunday morning, where I'll give a lecture on some, perhaps, halachic aspect of the High Holidays, or something in the Rambam, or perhaps something in Tanakh, and then there will be a colleague of mine who will either beforehand or afterwards give another shiur, and it'll be on a different topic. And often, the way that they set it up is one of them is more in the area of the legal nuances of a particular component of the holiday, such as the details of the mitzvah of shofar, and the other one will be more in the area of attitude, what's called hashkafa. Philosophy is not at all a translation for that. But hashkafa, the attitude, the way that we should approach things, the way we should appreciate things. And it is invariable that you will find a whole host of people who, first of all, a whole host of people who come to one of the classes, not the other, not because of the teacher, but because of the type of subject material. There's some people who are absolutely driven to listen to halachic lectures, and they're very concerned about the details of the law, and they want to do everything correct. The minute that there is a lecture on something which is about the history of the phrasing, or about the liturgy, the meaning of the liturgy, or about the experience of the day, they're not interested. And then you have a whole group of people who have the exact opposite. They are very interested in hearing the meaning of the day and the feeling of the day and perhaps some mystical ideas, but they really tune out the minute that you start getting legalistic. And what's interesting is that there are a lot of people who feel bad. They don't want to attend just one lecture, but you can tell in one lecture they're very engaged and very involved. In the other one, they're not very involved. And I find this on both sides. Sometimes they're very engaged in my lecture and not in the other one, and sometimes the opposite. And even within a particular lecture, so you have a particular rabbi that I know of who will give a lecture and he'll talk in very detailed, nuanced, and very sophisticated level about the halachot, let's say, of shofar, or the halachot of fasting and kippur, and the medical issues. And people are taking notes copiously and asking questions, getting every detail down. And then for the last 5 minutes, he wants to say, to suggest an idea, a thought about the significance of fasting and Yom Kippur in a more of an attitudinal framework and a perspective framework as opposed to a legal framework. And you could see the slack jaw. You could see suddenly the same people who were taking notes copiously tune out. So it's not about the teacher. It's about the framework. This is, of course, a problem because neither extreme is healthy. To be totally focused on the legal nuances and to miss the issue of why we do these things and what we're supposed to gain from these things, what the experience is supposed to be, to know the details of the laws of shaking lulav, but not to understand what the lulav is supposed to be, what the experience of the lulav is to be missing really the heart and soul of everything. And of course, ultimately, somebody who's very, very intent only on the legal side and not on the attitudinal side will wither. And if they don't wither, then it's very hard for them to pass this on to their children because there's no love there, there's no excitement there, there's no passion there. There's just almost an obsessive fear about doing things right. On the other hand, of course, we know how empty and how problematic it is when people are all about the spirit and the feeling and aren't interested in the halachic detail. Judaism is made up of both sides. Therefore, what happens in the Torah? In the Torah, a child comes and says, "Ma ha'idot v'chukim v'mishpatim," and I believe that on some level there's a little bit of a critique about what this child's question is. Because, yes, it's wonderful, he's asking about the details and he wants to know the laws and he doesn't need to be provoked, he's initiating the conversation on his own, it's wonderful. But on the other hand, he's coming with a very focused question about the what, and he hasn't yet understood the why, which is obvious because his father has to tell him the why. So what does the Torah tell us to do? The Torah says when you got a child like that, answer him. But before you answer him, make sure he understands that there's an entire historic and experiential framework to this thing. We don't just have laws because we have them. We have these laws because we have a relationship with the Ribbono Shel'olam, with the Master, with our Master in Heaven, our Father in Heaven, that we have a history that connects us together, that we have the experience of the Exodus and the experience of coming to Har Sinai and what this means. Now we have to understand and what we were, the tremendous blessing that we received when we left Egypt and came to Mount Sinai was the covenant with God that involves these laws, and now we can look at the details. So the Torah gives us, shall we say, the first part of the answer. And I believe that what the Baal Haggadah is doing, the author of the Haggadah, is simply saying, of course you answer what it says in the Torah. Of course you give them the experiential framework and background. But don't stop there. Af atah mor l'kochat haPesach. Also, tell him the laws of the Pesach. Besides that, don't stop there. You're going to answer his question. He wants to know the halacha. Tell him the halacha. Teach him the halachot. Good. And this hopefully explains to us why this child is both regarded as a chacham and why we answer him in a way that's really different than the way that the Torah suggests. We'll be linking on this shiur a sheet that has a chart. It's only in Hebrew, but a chart that lists the questions asked by each one of the children, what each child is called in the Haggadah, and by the way, what each child is called in the Yerushalmi, which is not exactly the same, and the answer that we're told to give in the Torah, and the answer that we're told to give in the Haggadah, and the answer that we're told to give in the Talmud Yerushalmi. And you can take a look at that and see how very different the different rabbinic traditions go, and also, of course, how they deviate from the Torah. Good. We get then to the child who we call Tam, and the Yerushalmi, of course, as I mentioned in the last podcast, is called Tipesh, who says mazot. Now, what's he saying mazot to? He's saying mazot when he sees the separation of the firstborn of the flock and being brought to the Kohen. He says, what do you do? Why are you doing this? What's going on? And the answer we give him is God took us out with a strong hand, and Pharaoh was stubborn, and therefore God killed all the firstborn, and therefore I'm bringing all the firstborn. And by the way, the additional verse, which is often not recognized as being part of the father's answer, is, and you should put them for a sign on your hand, and for a tutafot between your eyes, a crown between your eyes, because God took us out with a strong hand. We read this entire piece out of context in the Haggadah, because in the original context, it has nothing to do with Pesach, as I mentioned, and in the original context, it has everything to do with farm life and what the child experiences, but there's a powerful lesson here. And a powerful lesson is that Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, is such a central and seminal event in our history and in our existence and in our awareness that, first of all, many things that we do at all times of the year, many things that we do on a daily basis, are associated with the Exodus. Think about how we connect Tzitzit to the Exodus. And I mentioned the Exodus in the last line of the Parsha of Tzitzit. Think about the prohibition against usury, or the warning to be very, very careful with how we treat the stranger and the convert, etc., all associated with the Exodus. Every Shabbat is a Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim. Every Yom Tov is a Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim. Our entire existence is frameworked around that. And so therefore, at any time of the year, when something happens which is in any way associated with the Exodus, we take the opportunity, when the child asks the question, to say, aha, let me tell you about the basis of Jewish history, which is the Exodus, Makat B'chorot, is the particular association with the thing that you saw. You saw me separating the firstborn of the flock, so the component of the Exodus that I'm going to share with you is the striking of the firstborn and the consequent obligation to sanctify our firstborn. But that's a significant lesson here, is that we use those opportunities. The last child who shows up, as it were, is a child who, as I mentioned in the last shiur in Rabbi Elon's name, may not even be an independent child. May even be the answer, the statement that's made, we got to tell the mincha, may even be what you say to the child who asked the question about the Korban Pesach the day before. Because within the context of the book of Shmot, that's the next time you talk to a kid after you made your declaration. So you're told, and the context here is, for 7 days you have no chametz, you eat matzot, and you tell your child by Yom Hahu, and this will take us to the end of the passage and the end of tonight's podcast. You tell your child on that day, saying, "Ba'avur ze, it is because of this that God acted for me when we left Egypt." What is going on here? What is the Bayoma? We got to tell the Mincha. What's the framework? So there is a general understanding, a rabbinic understanding, that the word is ze, this, in the Tanakh, nearly always, at least whenever possible, indicates that the speaker is pointing to a particular object. Example, the famous Midrash, that in Shirat HaYam, in the Song at the Sea, all of Bnei Israel sang, Ze Eli V'Yanvehu, this is my God and I will beautify him. One translation. This is my God, right? Herman Wouk used that in his very beautiful book, is his title. And therefore we lead to all the Midrashim that the lowliest maidservant who crossed the sea saw more intense vision of God than even the greatest of the prophets, because it says Ze'ili, as if she pointed to God. For instance, when you have the Pasuk, V'amar b'yomahu hinei Eloheinu zeh, kivinu zeh Adonai kivinu lo nagiu nesvacha b'shuato, this is God. The Gemara, the very, very end of Masechet Tanit, says that ultimately all the tzaddikim are going to be in a circle and they're going to point to God. Ze Hashem kivinu lo. When the verse says, V'zeh maseh menorah, this is what the menorah should look like, Chazal immediately comment, Moshe Rabbeinu did not know what the menorah should look like, so God gave him a picture of fiery menorah in the sky. And the same thing with Chodesh HaZeh Lachem and Zeh Yitnu with the half shekel. Every time you have the word Zeh, it seems to be pointing to something. So what's happening here? You got to tell the Vincha, you shall tell your child on that day, Ba'avur Zeh, and what's the Zeh? So in the Haggadah we read, B'sha'ash Yesh Matzah Maror Munachim Lefanecha. In other words, you point to the symbols at the table and say, this is why God took me out of Egypt. Now, what's the why with this particular child? So we understand, and going back again to take a page from Piaget, the great educator and educational theorist, Jean Piaget, children at different points in their development are able to deal with different levels of abstraction. And very young children who are first able to formulate the discussion and to comment on something and maybe even ask a question cannot deal with anything that's not concrete. And therefore, with those children, what do? We have show and tell. We have a matzah. We have maror. We have a korban pesach. We have wine. We have people wearing white clothes. We have people reclining. We have all sorts of physical things to point to and use them as models and explain what's going on. Note that this is the child who is generally understood to be the least developed child, the one who can't ask a question, and therefore we initiate. And how do we initiate? We initiate by pointing to things. And that explains the phrasing that appears at the tail end of the passage of the Arba Banim. The proper nusach of the Midrash is, V'igaratah levincha yachol mirosh chodesh. Meaning, the mitzvah is to tell your child. I might think you could do this mitzvah any time starting from the beginning of the month of Nisan, which is already the beginning of the season of redemption. And it's already the time at which Bnei Yisrael were given these mitzvot. Therefore, the Torah says, Bayom Ahu. You got to tell the Vincha Bayom Ahu. Means you have to tell them on that day. Meaning the same day that, what? That you were redeemed. But when were you redeemed? On the 14th, when you brought the Korban Pesach. So if all it said was Bayom Ahu, I would think that you could tell them on the 14th in the afternoon. Therefore, it says Ba'avur Zeh. Meaning you have to have the items to point to sitting in front of you on the table. And that is B'sha'ash Yesh Matzah Maror Munachim Lefanecha. The point of this whole thing, with which we will have to end tonight, and in Mir Tzashem at the beginning of next week, pick up this thread, is that there is one common component to the Haggadah side of discussion at the table, the side that involves the parent sharing a specific body of information to the next generation and transmitting it forward. And depending on the sophistication and the attitude and the maturity and the intellectual ability of that child, that is how much and how the parent will share it. That is that it needs to be done with symbols. It needs to be done with things around the table. And therefore, that mitzvah must not begin until nightfall when those items are at the table. And parenthetically, that mitzvah concludes when those items are no longer at the table. An item we're going to get back to when we discuss Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's participation in the all-night Seder in Bnei Brak. In the meantime, though, we will close it off for tonight. Wish everybody a wonderful Shabbat. And Mir Tzashem, we will have the fourth in the series on next Monday.